Our next guest, superstar basketball player LeBron James of the Cleveland Cavaliers, has made headlines almost every day this week for different reasons. He's been voted the league's MVP for the second year in a row. He was just named to the All-NBA first team for the third year in a row. And he's playing in the playoffs right now with an injured elbow. James and the Cavaliers are tied with the Boston Celtics at a game apiece, and Game 3 is tonight. LeBron James has been a sports star ever since he was on the cover of Sports Illustrated at the age of 17 when he was still in high school. He was the number one NBA draft pick out of high school, and at 19, he became the youngest rookie of the year in NBA history. James told his story in his memoir, Shooting Stars, now out in paperback. James, who was raised in Akron, Ohio by his single mother, also is the focus of More Than a Game, a documentary, now out on DVD, about the tight bond between James and his closest childhood friends, who shared not only a love of basketball, but also a level of trust. James has known Drew Joyce, Shion Cotton, and Willie McGee since junior high, and Romeo Travis since high school. They all talk about their friendship in this clip from More Than a Game.
We had a natural feel for each other. I'm not sure what it was. I guess it was just meant to be, but we had a chemistry for each other. It was basketball, but it was more friendship than anything.
We were all kind of like strangers, and we really bonded.
You know, I wanted to finally have some brothers that I can be loyal to and be trustworthy, and I think we all kind of shared that bond.
I just remember being over at LeBron's house one night, and they was just talking like you and I are good friends, you know what I'm saying? I mean, it was weird for me for somebody to express themselves to me, including another dude, another boy to me like that, you know what I mean? Like, they was more giving, they was more accepting, you know what I'm saying? Just got more comfortable.
The 5'4", that was like our identity.
Terry Gross spoke with LeBron James last year.
LeBron James, welcome to Fresh Air. Do you remember the very first time that you dunked?
Yeah, I was in eighth grade, and my middle school every year has a teachers versus students game. You know, they play the basketball team, and in warm-ups, I have no idea what got into me, but it was so electric in this gym. I think this gym holds probably like, it holds probably like, I'd say probably about 45 people in there. That's a lot, right, for eighth grade game, 45 people. And it, you know, the crowd was, you know, the students is having a great time. And, you know, we got out of school early. And in the warm-ups, I just decided, I don't know, I was going to jump as high as I could and try to dunk. And I did it. You know, I went up and dunked the basketball. I don't know what got into me that day. And then when the game started, I got a breakaway and did it again. And the crowd went crazy. And that was like one of the best moments of my whole life.
You're one of the people who went very suddenly from poverty to wealth. You write in your book, you know, your mother had you when she was 16. Her mother died when you were 3. It was hard for your mother to support you. You had to keep moving a lot because of eviction notices and, you know, rent problems. Did you think of basketball as a way out, as more than just a game?
Well, I think it is more than a game. Basketball, and I think sport, period, gives you an opportunity to forget about anything that may be going on in your life. Back away from that particular sport that you may be playing. You know, I definitely used the game to get my mind off some of the bad things that may have been going on as a child.
Like what?
You know, it's just things you never want your kids to see. You know, violence and things like that. You never want your kids to see that. So, you know, I used the game of basketball to keep me away from that.
Now, how did you meet the three players who, along with you, became known as the Fab Four? Three players that you went to junior high and high school with and became real winners together?
Well, I met Little Drew through the same Little League team, through the same league. It's the ARB, it's the Akron Recreation Bureau. And Little Drew just so happened played on our rival team. We was the Summer Lake Hornets, and he played for the Ed Davis Dream Team All-Stars. So we were rivals, and, you know, we met through that way. Willie played on my team. He played on the Summer Lake Hornets with me. And I met Romeo on the football team where I played before basketball on the East Dragons.
What was it about this group that made you work so well together? Like, what was, describe something about, like, the chemistry on and off the court that made you work like that?
Well, the chemistry off the court is why we were so good on the court. You know, we looked at each other as brothers. I mean, at the time it was the Fab Four. It was myself, Drew, Shion Cotton, and Willie McGee, and we, you know, we used that off the court friendship, that, you know, going to, I don't know, going to McDonald's together, playing basketball outside together, you know, driving to West Virginia to play in the AAU tournament, you know, things like that. And then when we got on the court, it was like, okay, this is the easy part.
Little Drew is called Little Drew because he was little. He was, was like 5'3 or something when you were in high school?
Yeah, when we was a freshman, that's good for him. When we was a freshman, Drew was about 4'11". We were freshmen in high school. He came off the bench that year, our freshman year, and he was a heck of a shooter. And you know, he was, anytime you left him open, he for the most part wasn't going to miss. And you know, he did that from game one all the way to the last game of the season in the state championship.
So you, Drew, Willie McGee, and Shion Cotton wanted to go to the same high school together so that you could continue to be teammates. And you went to a high school that no one expected you to go to. Everybody expected you to go to, is it pronounced Buchtel?
Buchtel.
Buchtel, which you describe as the school of choice for black athletes. It was a public school, but instead you went to a predominantly white Catholic school, St. Vincent's. Would you explain how you ended up, the four of you, going to St. Vincent's?
We ended up going to St. Vincent because little Drew at the time, remember I told you he was only about 4'10", 4'11". He didn't think Buchtel was going to give him an equal opportunity to play for them. And when Drew realized that, you know, he was like, you know, I'm not going there. He had started going to this Sunday night clinic that our high school coach eventually, Keith Dambrow, was holding. And he seen how much confidence he had in Drew. And Drew was like, hey, I'm going to St. V, guys. And it was tough at first, you know, because we knew really nothing but Buchtel at the time. I mean, we went to all the Buchtel games and all the Buchtel events, the football games, everything, and our minds was going to Buchtel. So, you know, when Drew just made that decision, you know, it was difficult for us, but, you know, when we finally sat down and really came together as friends, we was like, hey, we need to stick together, and, you know, we're going to let you make this call, Drew. We're going to follow you.
Now, you write in your book that some people turned against you when you decided to go to St. Vincent because they thought you were turning your back on the African-American community. Could you describe that period and what your response to that was?
Well, it was difficult. I mean, in the summer of, I went to in the summer of 99, I think that was my freshman year. That summer before, you know, in between eighth grade and ninth grade, you had to, you know, even though we had decided to go to St. V, we were still playing in the black community. We were still playing basketball against those same kids and those same adults that really wanted us to come, you know, to Buchtel. So it was difficult, but I think our friendship and what we had and what Coach Drew was way more powerful than anything anybody else had ever said for us or, you know, about us.
You won the state national championship your senior year, so mm-hmm. the bet paid off. The fact that you and your three friends decided to go to St. Vincent together, it paid off. And then, you know, you were an NBA draft. You joined the Cavaliers when they were in last place. I know you're very fond of Cleveland. You grew up in Akron. Why would you want to join a team that was in the last place?
Well, first of all, if you know, I had no choice. You know, that's why it's called a draft. They pick who they want. And,
good point.
things like that. But the fact is, when I was drafted to that team, I felt like I could make an impact. I felt like I could help. You know, they only won 17 games the year before I got drafted. But, you know, I felt like my talents could help that franchise. And, you know, I think the city of Cleveland has some of the best fans that the world has to see. And, you know, I was happy to go into that experience and take my talents to that team also.
I'm sure it was your dream to be in the NBA when you got there. How did it compare to what you expected?
It was everything and more. I always wanted to be in the NBA and have a uniform with my name on the back. They say James across the back of the jersey. And I can remember my first NBA game, which we played in Sacramento, and to just be out there and to see the fans and to see, you know, the cameras and to see my teammates and see the opposing team on the NBA floor in the NBA game. It was like, wow, it was like somebody like, please don't pinch me because I know I'm dreaming.
Now, you know your one-handed full court shot?
Mm-hmm.
How did you develop that?
I don't know. It's just, I guess I'm the chosen one, I guess. I guess Sports Illustrated was right.
There you go. Now, describe the feeling of taking a shot and the ball's like circling around the rim and then like falls out instead of going in. Well, and the game's really close.
No, that's happened multiple times. It's not a pleasant feeling, you know, especially when you feel like that was the one. You know, you shoot the ball. All basketball players know when that shot feels great, you know, and then the ball gets on the rim and it plays with the rim and it's like goes in and then it feels like some imaginary hand punches it back out of the net. That's like, it's not a really good feeling at all.
Now, you said that you think what makes your approach to basketball different, like your approach is based on like your mental approach to the game. I'm paraphrasing here, but it was something like that. So what do you mean by that?
That my mental aspect of the game is
mm-hmm.
what?
That's the key to your...
Oh, it is. I mean, I think the game more than I really play. I mean, I can play the game pretty good, too. But I really think the game and approach the game mentally more than physically. You know, and, you know, that's watching film. That's knowing your opponent's likes and dislikes, his pros and cons, what he like to do, what he don't like to do, who are we playing against this particular team, you know, what do they like to do, what do they don't like to do, and that's the way I approach the game. I feel like skill-wise I'm going to be okay, but who's gonna outthink the game more than the next man in front of him?
You know, we've been talking through the interview about the three other friends, teammates who you went to junior high and high school with. What are they doing now?
Well, my four best friends right now, Drew Joyce is playing professionally in Poland. Romeo Travis is playing professionally in Germany. Shion Cotton is playing football at Walsh University in Canton, Ohio, and also in school. And Willie McGee is getting his is going to graduate school at the University of Akron and also working with the men's basketball team.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
LeBron James speaking to Terry Gross last year. More Than a Game, the documentary about his loyalty to his closest childhood friends, is now out on DVD. And James and his Cleveland Cavaliers play tonight in the NBA playoffs in Game 3 against the Boston Celtics.
All the eyes in the Gulf of Mexico, of course, have been turned toward the dramatic oil spill there. But, you know, any other year, any other time, this time of the year, people would be thinking of something else, the hurricane season. In about 3 weeks, the hurricane season will be here, and a lot of the forecasts are now saying that the right climatic ingredients could be in place to make this a really big year for hurricanes, maybe on par with big years like 2005. And you remember that year. That was the year that spawned Hurricane Katrina. So what are the factors that come together to create a big storm season? How much can we tell about the upcoming season by studying conditions in the past? Isn't climate change tweaking the variables a little bit? Joining me now to talk about that and his forecast for the hurricane season is Phil Klotzbach. He is lead forecaster for the hurricane forecast team at the Colorado State University in Fort Collins, Colorado. He's also a research scientist in the Department of Atmospheric Sciences there. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much for having me.
Tell us about the forecast. It looks pretty intense.
Yeah, well, the latest forecast that we put out was in early April, and at that time we were calling for a pretty active hurricane season. A typical season has about 10 named storms, 6 hurricanes, and 2 major hurricanes. We're currently predicting 15 named storms, 8 hurricanes, and 4 major hurricanes. So if you kind of want to summarize it with one number, about 160% of the average season. So, yeah, pretty active.
And so it looks something like 2005, which spawned Katrina.
Well, no, not necessarily. I mean, 2005 had 15 hurricanes and 28 named storms, so we're not necessarily expecting to see that much activity. But certainly we do feel that conditions are going to be a lot more conducive for a lot of storms than, say, they were last year when we only had 3 hurricanes.
So is it basically looking through the hurricane record, the seasonal records, the maps, and comparing what you see on those when it was a stormy year and seeing what's shaping up this year?
Yeah, that's correct. Basically, the way that we come up with our forecast is we use historical data and we use the past. Like you said, what we do is we basically know which years in the past were active hurricane seasons and which years in the past were quiet seasons. And then what you do is you try to look and see what sets of climate conditions, what was the atmosphere like and what was the ocean mm-hmm. like in active seasons in the past versus inactive seasons in the past. And you find that certain sets of conditions do occur. One of the common ones that we use is El Nino. When you have El Nino, which is warmer than normal waters in the tropical Pacific, you tend to have fewer storms in the Atlantic. And that's what we saw last year, but that El Nino appears to be dying out now, so we don't think we're going to have that to help keep the season quiet this year.
Mm-hmm. So the El Nino is dying down, and what other conditions make it look like a bad hurricane season?
Well, one of the things that we've really noticed over the last several months is we've seen a very strong warming of the waters in the tropical Atlantic. The waters right now in the tropical Atlantic are running at near record levels, so certainly very toasty right now. Now, just because they're warm now doesn't guarantee they're going to be warm during the August to October period when we see most of our major hurricanes. But there is a fairly strong correlation there, so that's another reason why we expect the season to be pretty active with the very warm waters that we have right now.
A question coming from Second Life from Pierre Mantis Berman says, will the oil spill in the Gulf have any impact on the hurricane season?
Well, that's a good question. There's been a lot of people asking similar questions. I think really when you get any sort of storm of any strength, say even a tropical storm, basically the winds would mix the oil and the water together, so you wouldn't necessarily have the reduced evaporation from the oil slick. I think one of the big concerns is that if we did get a hurricane in the Gulf and it happened to, have a fairly significant storm surge, it could drive the oily water further inland, which could make a real mess. So I think certainly there is some cause for concern, but obviously there's a lot of question as to how much oil is going to be left by the time that the hurricane season really ramps up.
Yeah, when we don't know the answer to that question yet.
No, exactly. We don't know the answer to that question, and hopefully we won't find out the answer this year. Mm-hmm.
So when you say really ramps up, What range of time are you speaking of?
Well, basically, the most active, even though the hurricane season starts on June 1st, and you certainly can get storms in June and July, about 90 to 95% of all major hurricane activity occurs after the 1st of August. So, and if you really wanted to pick a one-month time period where most of the storms occur, it's between about August 20th and September 20th is when you get, say, about 65, 70% of all your major hurricane activity. So that's the month where storms are most likely, but certainly you can obviously get storms in August and October and even earlier and later in the season.
Do you see any connection between climate change and hurricanes in terms of the increasing water temperature, stuff like that? We keep hearing that the storms may be more intense.
Well, that's a good question. Basically, what we find is that especially in the tropical Atlantic, there's this kind of multi-decadal variability where you'll go for...
Wait, what?
25 to 30-year variability. It's multi-decadal.
Right.
It's a new term that they've, I don't know if atmospheric scientists coined it or what. But,
I thought you said mopey at one point. I was moping around.
Multi-decadal. So okay. Variability that occurs on, say, 25 to 40-year timescales.
Yeah.
Basically, we've seen these periods in the past where the tropical Atlantic warms up quite a bit. We see a lot of major hurricanes, and then it gets quiet, and we have fewer. And if you look back at historical data, you can see these cycles going back to the late 19th century. So we haven't, and what I've done a little work looking globally at storms.
Right.
And now obviously observational data globally isn't always the greatest, and you may have some uncertainties, especially as you go further back in time. But based on the data that we have, we really haven't seen any observable trend in storms getting more intense with the fact that even water temperatures are warming, because even if humans are causing global warming and causing the temperatures to warm, the warming doesn't just take place at the sea surface, it also takes place at upper levels in the atmosphere. And basically, the atmosphere doesn't really become a lot less unstable. Basically, the stability of the atmosphere remains about the same, so you wouldn't necessarily expect to see stronger storms.
Well, Phil, thanks for the forecast, and we'll keep our fingers crossed, hoping we have a safe hurricane season.
Yes, here's hoping.
All right, Phil Klotzbach is the lead forecaster for the hurricane forecast team at Colorado State University in Fort Collins.
We're going to turn now to that oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. A 40-foot-tall dome is being positioned this morning over the spot where the oil is spilling out in hopes of containing the crude that's spewing up from a mile underwater. Some of that leaking oil has washed onto barrier islands in the Gulf, threatening wildlife and fragile marshes. The oil slick is still miles from the popular beaches, but already the tourism industry is feeling the impact. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports from the Alabama coast.
The sugar white sand on this part of the Gulf Coast is so fine it squeaks when you walk. It's glistening in the May sunshine, with aqua green waves from the Gulf gently lapping the shore. There's no sign of what lurks beyond the horizon.
It's beautiful down here.
Dave O'Hara is a home inspector from Fairhope, Alabama. He's relaxing on the public beach in Gulf Shores.
I have a little time to come down, so I decided to come down and enjoy it a little bit. I don't really want to be down here with the globby oil all over the place if it does happen. I want to see it the way it is now. It may be a long time before it's this way again.
The beach isn't as crowded as it should be in early May, and the outlook isn't so good with the peak season just weeks away. Tom Godwin owns a property management company.
Regardless if a drop of oil hits our beach or not, this summer's pretty much been shot as far as bookings and reservations and any kind of profitability that 2010 would bring.
He's one of about 700 people who crowded into the Gulf Shores Civic Center for a meeting this week on the oil spill. BP representative Bruce Johnson tried to assure the worried business people the company was doing all it could.
We're going to clean up that spill. That's our commitment. And we will honor every legitimate claim. And that's a promise.
But Alabama Attorney General Troy King calls that lawyer speak. And some local officials are frustrated with the response. Orange Beach Mayor Tony Kennan says the oil spill has the potential to create an economic tsunami.
For them to clean up their mess is not a favor to me. What I want them to do is clean the mess up and then clean up the economic mess that they're leaving behind that could affect our folks for years to come, and it's going to put some people out of business right away.
The contractor who is handling claims for BP, Mike Schulte, says he's already writing checks for people who make their living from the water. But he says businesses on land will have to wait until the oil flow is stopped and a final adjustment can be made. When Schulte left the meeting before taking questions, several people followed him out the door.
How come you call a meeting for us down here and you leave the meeting for it subway for questions get to answer? You're wasting my time.
No, sir.
Why'd I even come down
here? No, sir. I got to go write checks.
Others are hesitant to file now for fear they would be giving up the right to seek future compensation. Patsy Carlton has a beach photography business. She says even once the oil spill crisis is over, it could drive away tourists for a long time to come.
My concern is not just this summer, but next summer and the next summer. How do you make a claim? And if you make a claim now, how does it affect the next several years?
The good news from the meeting came from State Health Officer Don Williamson, who said there are no plans to close public beaches if tar balls reach the Alabama shore. Williamson said there isn't a health threat, but he acknowledged the perception.
Let me just be realistic. If you were the parent of a three-year-old, would you want your three-year-old to go swimming in oil-laden water? Precisely.
A real problem for a state that promotes itself as a family-friendly destination and where coastal tourism is a $2.7 billion industry. For its part, the state is producing television ads to deploy once the spill is over.
With the nation's largest artificial reef and the longest pier in the Gulf Coast, people from everywhere come to Alabama and leave with fish.
Orange Beach boat captain Richie Russell hopes sea life will rebound after the spill. His dolphin cruises have been grounded for nearly 2 weeks now.
We hold up to 49 people, and 15 is our minimum to go out, and we can't even get that. You know, I can't make no money. Behind on my bills, marina rents due, house notes, you know, just everyday life.
The angst here on the Alabama Gulf Coast is playing out to the east in Florida as well, where tourism is an even bigger industry. But beaches along the eastern seaboard are reporting a jump in business, seemingly benefiting from the oil that looms in the Gulf of Mexico. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Orange Beach, Alabama.
In 2008, Marvel Comics superhero Iron Man came to the screen, starring Robert Downey Jr. as billionaire arms mogul Tony Stark, who wears an iron suit that lets him fly around and zap bad guys. In light of that film's superheroic box office total, Downey and director Jon Favreau are back with Iron Man 2, which also features Mickey Rourke as an electrified villain called Whiplash. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
As I watched Iron Man 2, one phrase went through my head. It's the compliment the male characters paid to one another in director Jon Favreau's first film, Swingers. you're so money. Iron Man 2, you're so money. I don't mean garish or gaudy or without a sense of humor, but in all the superhero leagues in all the world, Robert Downey Jr.'s Tony Stark has the swankiest pad, a cliffside Malibu mansion that would make Bruce Wayne drool with envy. In his cool, low-lit lab, a computer with a smooth British voice supplies his needs, while sexy A-list foils like Gwyneth Paltrow and Scarlett Johansson sashay in and out. Viewers might ask, can money buy a good movie? Not always, but in this case, yes. Iron Man 2 is a smart piece of work. It doesn't have the emotional heft of Superman 2 and Spider-Man 2, those two twos that outclassed their ones. But Favreau and screenwriter Justin Theroux have paced it like a screwball comedy, with fast-talking dames and ping-pong zingers that show off Downey's expert timing. After promoting Paltrow's Pepper Potts to CEO, he needs a new assistant, and Johansson's Natalie Rushman from the legal department looks super promising.
She is from legal, and she is potentially a very expensive sexual harassment lawsuit if you keep ogling her like that. Yes, and I've got three excellent potential candidates that are lined up and ready to meet you.
I don't have time to meet. I need someone now. I feel like it's her.
No, it's not. What, are you going to Google her now?
I thought I was ogling her. Oh, wow. Very, very impressive individual. She's fluent in French, Italian, Russian, Latin. Who speaks Latin?
No one speaks Latin. No, it's a dead language.
Iron Man 2 does have a plot, and it's functional. It starts where the first film ended, with Stark admitting publicly to being the guy in the iron suit flying around battling baddies. Iron Man peddled a bogus but appealing fantasy that an American from a family that made its fortune selling weapons to kill people in far-off countries could himself become a weapon for peace. So you could, if inclined, applaud the anti-military industrialist complex message, but also cheer for a superhero who's the product of military industrialist ingenuity. Either way, America is so money. At first, Iron Man 2 adds a new wrinkle. Stark gets subpoenaed by a Congress that resents his boast of having, quote, successfully privatized world peace. But his chief Senate antagonist, played by Gary Shandling, turns out to be the puppet of rival, unscrupulous weapons maker Justin Hammer, played by Sam Rockwell, with the perfect ratio of unctuousness to menace. So the politics in the end are moot, and we're left with special effects fighting other special effects. To be fair, they're sensational, and we never lose sight of the characters behind them. Stark has a plug in his chest made from the element palladium that keeps him alive, but is also poisoning him. So his feats are double-edged. The more superheroic, the greater the cost to the superhero. Plus, he's facing off against a Russian supervillain, Mickey Rourke's Ivan Vanko, who has a chip on his shoulder the size of an asteroid. Even in prison, it's clear Vanko has the upper hand. Stark has no idea where Vanko got the technology for his electrified supersuit, or how the two men are linked.
You come from a family of thieves and butchers. And now, like all guilty men, try to rewrite your own history. And you forget all the lives the Stark family has destroyed.
Speaking of thieves, where did you get this design?
My father, Anton Vanko.
Oh, I never heard of him.
My father is the reason you're alive.
The reason I'm alive is because you had a shot, you took it, you missed.
Did I?
Mickey Rourke's recent reemergence is a beautiful thing, the way Dennis Hopper's was after Blue Velvet. They're actors who entered death spirals of excess and were resurrected, though much the worse for wear, and are equal parts inspiring and scary. As Vanko, Rourke sports messy tattoos and a mouthful of metal from which he spits blood, smiling, of course. Decked out as Whiplash, he throws out arms extended by long and lethal electric tendrils. He gives Iron Man 2 a badly needed sting, a glimpse of personal demons a movie so money can't buy.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org.
Lady Macbeth famously tried to clean her conscience by rubbing invisible bloodstains off her hands. Well, Shakespeare was on to something. Hand washing can ease psychological turmoil. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports that soaping up may help us feel better about choices we've made.
A few years ago, scientists discovered the Macbeth effect. Hand cleaning seemed to ease the guilt people felt after being asked to recall something unethical they'd done in the past. This fascinated Spike Lee. He's a psychology researcher at the University of Michigan, who wondered if hand washing could influence emotions beyond a sense of moral purity. After all, people have this idea of starting over with a clean slate.
Maybe there's a broader phenomenon here. Anything from the past, any kind of negative emotional experiences, might be washed away.
He and a colleague named Norbert Schwartz decided to see if they could wash away one kind of bad feeling, the lingering unease we feel after being forced to choose between two attractive options. Lee says psychologists know that people usually try to soothe this inner conflict by later exaggerating the positive aspects of whatever it is they chose.
In other words, after they make the choice, they will like the chosen option more than before the choice.
The researchers figured that people wouldn't need to do this kind of justification if hand washing could relieve their tension instead. To test this idea, the researchers first asked students to rate a list of music CDs. They then offered the students two of the CDs and told them to select one as a take-home gift. Afterwards, some students lathered up with soap. Others only looked at the soap or sniffed it. As the researchers had suspected, those left with dirty hands later gave their chosen CD a higher score than they had on the initial ranking. But the hand washers didn't.
They feel no need at all to justify the choice.
The hand washers ranked their chosen CD pretty much as they had before. In the journal Science, the researchers report that they saw the same effect in a similar experiment that let people use antiseptic wipes.
Apparently, you do not need water and soap.
Norbert Schwartz says, on the one hand, so to speak, washing may help decision makers by rinsing away mental turmoil. But on the other hand,
we may not do you a favor when you wash your hands and you're not doing that cognitive work to make your decisions appear in the best possible light.
Schwartz says it may be that if people don't justify their choices, they may end up feeling more remorse in the long run. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
And we've been hearing a lot about bad water this week. Water covered in oil, threatening the shores of Louisiana, Florida, Alabama, and Mississippi. Water washing away lives and music in Nashville. So we thought we'd end the week on a more hopeful note, this classic sung by Johnny Cash.
Oh, when times get rough and friends just can't be found, like a bridge over troubled water, I will lay me down, like a bridge over troubled water, I will lay me down. When you're down and out.